Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done at Brock University by the faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to a pair of Brock History Co-op students who have brought back the Brock University Historical Society. We talk research writing and making time for it with Thomas Farrell, Chair of the Department of Applied Linguistics at Brock. And research matters. Indeed it does. We meet a couple of Brock students acting as Research Matters student ambassadors ahead of a province-wide webinar scheduled for November 26th that will connect university researchers to the broader community. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. A Brock University tradition is being revived after sitting dormant for almost a year. The Brock Historical Society is back and hoping to make history up on the escarpment all over again. Two Brock History Co-op students, John Raimondo and Joey DeLazari, have taken the reins of the newly reformed society and, along with Luke O'Brien, have begun to actively promote the group through social media channels such as Facebook and Twitter, in order to generate more of an interest in history. Last month, they held their first official meeting and also their first official outing to the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. John and Joey joined us in the CFPU studios recently to discuss the Brock Historical Society and where they go from here. And I asked, whatever happened to the original Brock Historical Society?
Well, I think the original society didn't have that much interest into it. It just kind of fell. So that's when me and John came in and we took it over. Originally, it was started in the summer by Mark Bernstein. And unfortunately, due to circumstances, Mark had to leave and he went to a different school. So me and John kind of took up the reins. And from then, it's kind of been clear sailing, right, John?
Exactly. What happened was in September, the first week, Brock usually has vendor fair for all the students that are coming back. You go to a vendor, they usually have clubs there for BUSU, and people take interest in that. And Joey and I noticed that there was no club for the Historical Society. So that's when the idea clicked, and we messaged each other, and we thought, you know what, we'll take the initiative and we'll start it up. It'll be good for the history students and the faculty to do this.
Yeah, and you know, it's been great for me and John at the same time, too. We've been friends all throughout high school and middle school, and the one thing we've always had in common was history, and it's great that we could bring that into a university setting.
Now, did you know about the history of the Historical Society before you got started? You must have known about the society being around at some point before this.
Yeah, we were actually in society first year, both John and I. There was a Facebook and we were a part of it, and there was a few meetings which we have attended, but we noticed the one meeting that we went to, there was only three or four people there, and there wasn't really a turnout and there wasn't really interest on it too. So we were in the club actually before we came and kind of took it over. So there was a history behind there.
Now, was it just a lack of interest in the society because people are too busy or they didn't know about some of the history? What was the reason for this lack of interest in the club?
I think it was just the way that the club was structured. When John and I came in, we kind of structured the club into a different way where it wasn't just movie nights, it wasn't just historical events, but it's also academic events at the same time too, because as history students or even as university students, we're all very busy with our academics, and that kind of, I believe, took over the reins of that. A lot of people don't have enough time to put all into the club because they also have their studies on top of it too, right?
Yeah, we noticed in the original club that the movie nights that they had, it was good to bring people together and gain that relationship with among members, but we found that you couldn't get anything out of that. It wasn't helping Brock and it wasn't doing anything for the community. So the way we structured this new Brock Historical Society is that we're going to get a face in the community, not just at Brock, and we're going to do things that'll take action and help promote history.
Was it difficult to get a lot of people interested in this once you decided amongst yourselves that this is something that we want to undertake ourselves? Was there a lot of support immediately to going ahead with the society?
Well, at first we asked our partner with us, Luke O'Brien, if, you know, he will kind of tag along with us and help us. And you know what? He was 100% on with us. He's like, yeah, this is awesome. This is great. I'm totally on. And it was kind of small talk at first because we're all in classes, so we start talking to people within our classes, and they're totally on for it too. So at the same time, it's one to say that, of course, I'm totally on for this. It's another one to get them signed up and to come to meetings too. So it's easy to get the members, but to keep the members and have them coming to the events, it's exactly. Kind of a strain, but at the same time, it's something that's worth pushing for.
We got the members through a lot of our friends. The word of mouth spread easily. We have a lot of friends in the history program as well, but what we found is that we didn't just limit ourselves to history majors. We have a couple other friends and members that are of different majors as well that still have that interest in history. It's still something in the back of their mind that they want to learn more.
Now, you don't have to be a history major to be a member of the society, though.
No, we are with the Brock University Student Union. That's what we were a club under there, and we accept all students from any major because, you know what, students that are in political science major do have an interest within history and do take history classes, and, you know, they may eventually want to switch into a history major. I know one member that we do have, he started off as an English major and realized that history is his forte. History is something that he loves to do, so he switched over to history. And maybe that's something we're hoping for through this society too, is a lot of people are realizing, you know, history is not just the fact, it's something totally different, so they come switch into the major.
Yeah, the trick with history is bringing it to life. It's not just dry print in a book that you pull off a shelf in the library somewhere. The idea, I think, is to make it much more interesting and much more exciting for today. How do you do that?
A lot of people, like we said, the profs that we have within the department, they're awesome. It's more of a passion that they have for history. I always say to a lot of people, Professor Sampson, when he is projecting, when he's lecturing in class, he's so into it that you feel like sometimes he's going to fall off the stage because he's right on the edge, and it's actually so great to see. It actually, a lot of profs made my interest in history a lot greater because of that. And it's easier to have a passion for it too when you see other people with a passion for it.
As well, there was a couple of high school teachers that we had throughout high school that showed that passion as well, which inspired Joey and I to look at history and kind of think of it differently than what was the stigma towards it. We also looked at it as a stepping stone to go into a different career. That's something that Joey and I are really trying to push with this society, is that you're not just limited to be a teacher. You could become a lawyer. A lot of political science and history majors actually go into law after. It's a stepping stone to get you into that career.
Yeah, I was going to ask what your career aspirations were as history majors. You've obviously given this some thought. For you two, where do you go once your university days are done?
Well, for me personally, I've always loved law. I want to be a lawyer, and the reason I went into history is because you look at a history student and you look at the papers that we do write, is within that paper you have to make a thesis, so you have to have a point that you're going to prove, and then you use the primary and secondary sources to prove this point, so then you could kind of translate that into law. You have to use different sources to prove your point within a court case. There's no other program that rivals that. History is the best way to possibly do that, in my view.
Yeah, law is definitely a field that we've all taken interest in. For me personally, I found that I haven't limited myself. I've thought of many different options. Right now I'm looking at becoming a professor, but as well, like, I thought about law before. How I look at our history degree is that there's no rush, really. For Brock, they provide actually a really great master's program for a year that you can get your master's degree. So what I've been thinking is, with a history degree, we learn so many skills that are necessary in any job. Critical thinking is very, very big. The ability to research and ask questions. We think of the bigger picture and relate everything. And just skills like that, I look at as perfect in any career. So I was thinking, for me, I could travel, go to Europe, and maybe teach there as well. So I haven't really limited myself.
I'm going to be honest with you. A history major is not a sexy title.
No, it's not.
No.
So I suspect there may be a little bit of a stigma attached to this. History. It's not a sexy subject. How do you guys get around that? How do you work with that?
It's a lot of explaining. telling people that, because, you know, you go into your somewhere social and you tell someone, oh yeah, I'm at Brock and I'm a history major.
Oh.
And people say, oh, there's no jobs out there for teachers. And then that's when me and John kind of give each other a look, like, all right, take a deep breath. And we tell them, you know what, you don't just have to be a teacher. And like we said before, there's so many different things that you could possibly do with the history majors. One of our main goals, and we posted this on our Facebook page, is to change the social stigma about that. So to change exactly what you said, that it's not boring and you don't have to be a teacher or a historian or just someone within that field.
I think there's really a stigma attached to not so much history generally, but Canadian history. This is a real problem, and it's something that I've been aware of for a while. As Canadians, can we get excited about our own history? We tend to look over the border, or we tend to look to Europe, but I mean, we've got a lot of great history right here, and we just tend to, we yawn. It's a big yawn.
Yeah.
Therein, I suspect, therein lies the problem.
You're saying the history in Europe is great. There's nothing really that could compare to that, but like I mentioned before, Professor Sampson, professor at Brock, he actually specializes in colonial, I think it's Nova Scotia?
Nova Scotian history.
And in class, he tells people what he studies, and they go, oh, really? He has such a passion for it that it kind of makes it interesting. But that's one of the things with looking into history. You look into it and you find out that Canadian history actually is really interesting. And the foundation of our government, how our political system kind of came evolved, because we have two distinct nations. We have Quebec, which is a French primarily nation, and we have Ontario and the rest of Canada, which is English speaking. So you have two kind of nationalities that are colliding with each other. You don't really see that within other countries, that are two strong nationalities kind of colliding within our history. How did we deal with that? Like, can you possibly deal with that? And that's what makes Canadian history so interesting.
Yeah, as well. We look at Canada, it's a very new country, and we have a lot of history. Joy was mentioning earlier that Canada is kind of looked at as, if you look at the States, they always read history as the victors, right? But Canada, we were actually victorious in the War of 1812, and a lot of that history is left out in America. And as well, our region, the Niagara region, a ton of history here. As I know that we are a new country, but the history here is something we shouldn't ignore.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised the War of 1812, because here in Niagara, that's such a big part of our history, which we are celebrating and observing over this two-year period from 2012 to 2014. There's just so much going on. Does that help or hinder the history aficionados' cause? The fact that there's just so much going on with the War of 1812, everything else sort of tends to get forgotten, and we're only focusing on that. But it is such a big part of our history, especially here in Niagara.
Yeah, it's a great deal. You know, I look at it as a great thing that we're starting this club during this time period, because there's so much interest in it at the same time, too. Mm-hmm. And we do have, since the namesake of our university is named after Sir General Isaac Brock, mm-hmm. there's so much interest in that, too. One thing that we, as a group, we wanted to start was called the Brock Historical Minute. It'll be a minute that we do put on YouTube, and we discuss history, but we don't necessarily just get in the facts and dates. We ask questions as history majors. So Brock University, our motto is Sergi, and in Latin that means push on, and that eventually, apparently, that was Sir Isaac Brock's last words before, you know, he passed away within battle. But then if you look deeper into the document, it stated that he was shot right above the heart and he died instantly. So you ask questions, can you really trust the sources? Can you trust the medical sources? Can you trust the sources that he said the push on? So really, we're kind of taking what happened in the War of 1812 and we're trying to put it within the group.
Exactly. And also, looking at the Brock Historical Minute, we've been really thinking hard about it, and we think it's a pretty good idea that we have going. We're going to go to historical sites around the region, and not just sites, actually. We thought of going to talk to veterans and other people that have a history background, just because oral history from them is pretty much the best primary source you can have, their accounts from that period. And with this Historical Minute, we're looking to promote Brock and as well as the community, because on YouTube, it's basically worldwide, so it provides that market. So we can promote Brock. People will look at the videos and say, wow, like what university are those guys going to? What region is that? Why is there so much history there? And we just look at it as very good in that sense.
As far as the club is concerned, you had, a meeting in October? What, your first meeting?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, and then your first outing.
Yes, correct.
So what was the first outing?
We went to the ROM, the Royal Ontario Museum, and it was me and John and a few other students, and we had a blast. It was great.
It was a great day.
We have this one student, Victoria, and she's just full of knowledge, and she's so fun to talk to. And we will kind of go around, and she will grab your arm and say, oh my God, look how interesting this is. And it was just kind of great to see that. It's kind of a group bonding in a way.
Yeah, it was great. It was great to see other people's interest in history being kind of thrown out there among the members, and we were like, wow, like I didn't know that. So you also learn being history majors, and you also get to kind of teach as well. So it's interesting.
How many people did you get on the tour?
First, there was about 5 of us. A lot of people with their university. The money is tight. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing we've kind of learned with learning experience that, you know what, maybe at first we shouldn't really start with these major trips because money is tight with university students. So we're going to try to keep everything local and as less money as possible. So it was kind of a learning trip for us too at the same
for
time
us
too.
As well. Yeah, we took the GO train from Burlington. So we kind of mapped everything out. We were at Union Station. We had a trek, like we walked to the museum. So we just kind of got that in the back of our mind so that if we take anyone else, any other students, we have that idea of where to go, pubs to go to, what place to go to for food and such.
Well, there's no shortage of local sites that you would want to be able to visit. Do you have any particular favorites that you think, okay, before too long, we've got to go here?
Queenston. I know that's not in Toronto, but Queenston is something that we definitely want to. We want to record the Brock Historical Minute there. But still, like you said, Niagara-on-the-Lake and that part of the region really has so many historical sites that we could possibly go to. And we're such privileged that we lived in this kind of area that has that.
Mm-hmm. We're looking at definitely making a trip to the Sir Isaac Brock Monument. That's a big one, as Joy mentioned. And we're looking at different memorials around the city. I know there's a Meriton Memorial for the World Wars that we're looking to do a video there, as well as go to the Niagara Falls Museum. It's a very good museum. They just modernized it, actually, an architect out of Toronto. It just provides so much history. I think they have the original portrait of Sir Isaac Brock there as well, and they have some uniforms that you could put on and kind of play the part.
The Brock Monument at Queenston Heights Park, I'm not sure if you're able to go up it now.
No, I don't think so. I think it's still under renovation.
Yeah, it must have been about 20 years ago. I did do that walk up to the top of it inside, and it's very confined space, as you can imagine. But when you get up there, it's worthwhile because the view is spectacular. And so many people weren't even aware that you could go up it back then. So I'm hoping that at some point, hopefully in the very near future, you'll be able to go up that monument again because it's just wonderful when you get up there.
And another thing, right up top, the Brock Tower, if you get right to the top, there's kind of like a windows there. That's very scenic itself, too. So within, like I said, the Niagara region, we're very privileged to have such an area where it's full of history and scenic views like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now here's your $64,000 question. History majors, say we had this instant time machine that could take you back to whatever time period you would most like to go to. What would you like to go back and experience? You would sort of like be an observer of what's going on.
I don't know. That's
a difficult question.
That is
ask.
A very difficult question to ask.
As Joey and I both know, we're very interested in many periods of history. For me personally, I would probably want to go back to the Second World War, just that period from 1930 to 1945, because during that time, there was so much advancement. I know Joey and I always get into debates like this, but that period spurred around. In that short period, it was 100 years of technological advancement.
Yeah.
If you look back at that time, all the technology then, we still have today, it was either invented then and then improved on now. So just that period, to be like a fly on the wall, look at the decisions of leaders, to see what was like Hitler thinking, what was going through his head, looking at Roosevelt and how he was trying to prevent war in America, trying to keep them out of the war, but obviously that didn't work. It's a period that I'm very fascinated.
I love that kind of history. It's great. What I'm interested is in labor history. That's something that I really take a forte in. And something that I would love to go back is seeing all the immigrants come around just the turn of the 20th century and see the building of the Welland Canal. Because that's something that affects our region where we are right now. Personally, that's something that affects my family. My family came over here originally to work on the Welland Canal. So it's just seeing the reaction of immigrants and how they had to find a job with and working on the Welland Canal, how to find a place to live and kind of established their family in a new way, and which created St. Catharines, created Thorold, created Welland, and that's something that I really would like to see, just the development of that.
So for the nuts and bolts of the society, if anybody listening to the conversation today has been interested, hopefully by it, and wants to get involved, where should they go and what should they do to find out more about it?
We've created actually a Twitter account, and it's at Brock Historical. So if anyone's interested, they could follow us there. And as Joy and I have said, we will follow you back as well. But we have a Facebook group. So simply, if anyone that's interested, if they just go to the search bar, type in Brock University Historical Society, the group pops up and they ask to join, and we'll let them join as well. And they could see posts and everything that's going on. So even if you're not part of the group, you could understand what's happening.
Yeah, even if you're not a student at Brock and you're thinking about about going to Brock, come to the Facebook group. We will accept you, and you could see what is going on within the Brock history.
I forget who said it. I don't know if I'd join any club that would have me as a member. But if you're willing, I'm going to join. I'm going to be a part of it, too, because I love history, and
that's
I think
awesome,
it's great.
Yeah.
Cool. Listen, John and Joey, we thank you both for coming in as you head off and make some digital history with the new society, and we'll follow you and see what's going on, and thank you again for coming in.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And there we heard from two members of the Triumvirate who have reestablished the Brock University Historical Society, Joey DeLazari and John Raimondo. Their Twitter handle again is @BrockHistorical. They are indeed men of their words. I followed them, and they followed me back too. Works both ways. At Inquisitive Minds, we look at research, people doing research at Brock by faculty and students. But have you ever wondered just what is involved with conducting some of the research done at Brock? Just what occupies a professor's time, for example? Well, we did, and we went looking for answers, speaking to Thomas Farrell, chair of the Department of Applied Linguistics at Brock. Professor Farrell, as is the case with many other university professors, is a veritable writing machine of sorts. In his case alone, publishing 5 books in 1 year is not all that uncommon. So how does he do it? Professor Farrell joined us in the CFPU-FM studios this week to discuss that and many other topics relating to his field of study, and I began by asking about the Department of Applied Linguistics.
Actually, yeah. When I say I'm teaching in the Department of Applied Linguistics at Brock, many people, the first thing they say is, oh, you must speak many languages. And actually, that's not correct, because we don't actually speak many languages. Not many of my colleagues do. Some of my colleagues speak more than one, of course. But what we do is we analyze language, and from two different perspectives. Of course, we at the sentence level, we look at mostly English language and how language is formed, and then how children speak both in their first language and their second language. That's the key of our department. Let's say the core trunk of our department is linguistics in that sense. And then we have two different streams. We have speech and hearing sciences, and we have teaching English as a second language, and hence the first, how children and adults speak English as a first language and as a second language. So there's a different department for languages called modern languages. So our mission, so to speak, is to deliver programs for speech and hearing sciences and for TESL, which is teaching English as a second language.
Teaching English as a second language must be a challenge, because learning English is not the easiest language to learn, but to learn it as a second language makes it doubly difficult for the people who are doing it.
Well, especially if they're newcomers to Canada, but learning any language as a second language is difficult, and you have to have a basic aptitude first, and also you have to have the motivation to learn it. And so there are some people come in with baggage, and it might be difficult for them to pick up the language, but highly motivated people generally pick it up, adults. Children generally have no problem. They pick it up in the playground with other children, and so they're set, kind of. But yeah, it's a challenge, but it's also, actually, that's the stream that I focus on most in Brock, and part of my area is reflective practice for language teachers. We have a degree in applied linguistics with a strength in TESL. We also have a master's degree in applied linguistics, in which we take an academic stance towards higher levels of teaching English as a second language.
So how did you become interested in linguistics?
Many people don't realize my undergraduate degree is not in linguistics. It's actually in labor relations and human relations, yes, from Ireland. And then I became a teacher. And as I was teaching business English, I became interested in English as such. And then I started traveling, and I ended up in Korea. And I found out this new area called ESL, English as a second language, or in Korea it's called EFL, as I found out the distinction, English is a foreign language. English as a second language is you speak it as a second language, like newcomers coming to Canada. But as a foreign language, you would be living in a country like Korea, and it's not a second language, it's kind of just another language for business or something like that. So I discovered this new area, and then and this is 1978, believe it or not. And then there was something called applied linguistics, which was also a new area, and mostly developed in the UK and just developing in the US. I kind of grew up with the organization per se, its development. I'm kind of one generation behind the developers, and most of the people I admire in the field actually developed and discovered the field. And so I feel honored that I was able to develop with the field. And now it's blossomed into a huge field, a huge organization, and worldwide as such.
You mentioned Korea. You were in Korea just last month.
Yes.
You were giving the plenary address at the 21st Korea TESL Conference, yeah, in Seoul. So what was your address on?
Reflective practice, which is my area, actually. But before I talk about about that Korea TESOL is interesting because I'm a founding member of Korea TESOL in 1979, in which I was in a room with five other people and I was reading a book and I was told I was a founding member of the organization. That's how young all of this was at the time, to me and to others. And now, as you just said, their 21st annual conference, they invited me over. And yes, I gave the address on reflective practice, which is for second language teachers, which is basically teachers looking at their practice and looking at their beliefs and see, is there a match between what they believe in and what they actually do in the classroom. Sounds easy, but it's not. And I've been talking about that for the past 30 years, believe it or not.
Wow.
Let's talk about your extensive writing regimen. I think some people outside of the university setting wouldn't realize how much writing a professor does. They think they go to the university, they give a boring lecture, mark some papers, they're gone. That's it. There's just so much more to it than that.
Well, there is, actually. And even if I mow the lawn at 10 a.m. and on a Tuesday morning, my neighbors think I don't do anything. The tip of the iceberg for a professor, for people outside our particular field of work, is they see us teach. And if I say to you, I teach 6 hours a week, that sounds like you're in the classroom twice and you're lecturing, some may say boringly, for 3 hours at a spot, and like a Tuesday or a Friday or whatever, and then you go home, so to speak, and mow the lawn. But actually, that's just the tip of the iceberg. In order to be able to teach those 3 hours, A, you have to research, you have to be able to figure out, you're supposed to know what you're talking about, and each particular lecture takes me about, if it's a 3 hour lecture or 2 hour lectures, which is normal, and then we have seminars in Brock, which is different than other places, but a 2 hour lecture would take me about 3 hours to prepare if I'm doing it the second time. But if I'm doing it the first time, it takes me, you know, a week to prepare one lecture, if I do it right. Now, that's me, I don't know what my colleagues do, and that's up to them, but I'm part of the research background is your own particular area of research, and part of researching is writing as well. So what you see is us in the classroom, but what you don't see is me maybe writing all night or all weekend. You might see me mowing the lawn at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday morning and think, well, this guy has a great job. And a lot of people say, well, you're off for the summer. I mean, we have no class from April to September. And a lot of people say, oh, you're on holidays. And I'm saying, now I just say yes. I gave up trying to explain. But for me, it's prime time. I spend every day, all day writing. And writing is not busy work. It's, you know, you have to be in the right frame of mind and you have to set yourself in the right frame of mind. And so you have to be disciplined in doing that.
I could see why you would be able to do more in the summer because the lectures aren't getting in the way.
Yes. I actually like lecturing, so I wouldn't consider lectures getting in the way, to be honest. One of the reasons I like Brock is it allows me to do two things. It allows me to research and write, and it also allows me to teach. I wouldn't like to teach all the time without doing my research and writing, and I wouldn't like to research all the time without teaching because one feeds the other for me. It's circular in that sense. But during semester, when we are actually lecturing, I have less time to focus on my writing. As I said, it's not busy work. You have to be in the right frame of mind. And I find that in the summer months, I allow my mind to roam freer to be able to pick up on a particular issue or whatnot. For example, I took August off this year for my vacation, August. But actually, I only took about 3 days vacation because I spent the month trying to work out a new framework for reflective practice, of which I'm working on, an overall framework that has never been done. And I was writing two sample chapters for a book that I was trying to get a contract for. And last week I just got the contract, by the way, for Routledge, which is quite a big publisher. But I needed at least 3 weeks in August, every day, including the weekend. And yes, I do like to go for a cup of tea in the pub in the evening, as my wife will say. But even at that time, my mind is working on the particular framework. And I jog every day, and my mind is working on the framework. And in fact, most of my eureka moments were during the jog, not in the pub.
Thank you for saying that. And the reason I'm saying this is because I'm a big walker.
Yeah.
And I will walk every day. That's when I do my thinking.
Yep.
I solve more problems in my own personal world when I'm walking.
Yeah.
It's the best therapy. Yep. So you find what works for you and you go with it.
Yep, that's, and you said that correct. You find what works for you and there's no formula. The scary part, the lonely part of developing, in my sense, your writing skills or your thinking skills or your reflection skills is you have to find out who you are and you've got to trust yourself. And the lonely part is starting that journey and trusting yourself to try this, try that, whatever. So when some people ask me, well, how do I do it? Well, I just do what you just said there, Mike. I've tried to find my own path and you trust yourself stuff, and it's scary at the beginning, and you keep at it. I mean, when I started to write first, I got so many rejections, you wouldn't believe. I could fill the folders, files with rejections, and the acceptance was very thin for many, many years. But if you keep at it and keep believing in yourself and keep believing that you have a message for a particular audience, you'll succeed. And yes, the running for me is meditation in motion. You know, you have meditation, some people sit down, they do yoga, or they sit down, they breathe, and I can't do that. I'm a mover. And part of my moving is when I jog, I'm letting the mind wander into whatever direction it is if I don't have a particular issue I'm trying to solve. But I find that the meditation in motion helps me solve most of my issues, apart from the endorphins running around your brain in a kind of a high moment from the run, which makes you feel better anyway. And it's healthy.
So do the reflective moments help you when you get the proverbial writer's block? Something that must happen inevitably, someone who writes as much as you do.
Honestly speaking, I don't get writer's block because I trust myself. I don't write quality stuff every day. That's why I trust myself. Sometimes I know I'm not in the right frame of mind to write, so I'll read something. But what I do is the discipline comes in. This is for me only. I find my best time is in the morning, so I try to write in the morning from 8 around that time to about 11, depending on my schedule in Brock and everywhere else through the year. If I'm at home, that's exactly what I do, the basement. And my children have grown up, so it's easier for me to work at home. In school, it's different. And so I stick to that regimen. So even if I don't write something, let's say, cohesive, I may read something, but I'm always there and I allow the moments to happen. So some people, writer's block is not being able to get anything on the page. And part of that is somebody with a perfectionist, which I haven't, character, they think that every sentence and every word must be important and crucial. But I just let it out. I just write and it takes care of itself. And there's a very famous phrase that from E.M. Forrester, which I actually bring into my own work and I bring into my talks as well about writing as reflective practice. How do I know what I think until I see what I say? So how do I know what I think until I see on the page? So writing has a built-in reflective mechanism. You must stop. But the stopping and thinking is where the writer's block comes in. A lot of people stop and think too much rather than just letting it out. For example, and it worked. If you have never written and you're interested in writing, you start a journal and you just take a pen and paper. Well, that's my generation. People may word process as well, whatever way you want to do it. I still like the pen and paper. And you write down and you say, I've nothing to say. Then you write down, I've nothing to say. I've nothing to say. Just keep writing that. I guarantee you 100% within 5 or 10 minutes, you will have something to say. Everybody has a story. And my story is within reflective practice for language teachers.
As a writer myself, I understand where you're coming from, because even if you're writing, you can't possibly write the finished product the moment you start writing.
No.
So even if you're writing, you're forming the framework, the structure. You can always go back to it. That's the wonderful thing about writing, is you can refashion it any way you want. But if you get that first framework, you may never even use that, but it could be the launching pad for something else that you will use at some point in the future. So writing doesn't necessarily mean what you're writing is always the finished product. It can't possibly be.
No, and actually people who are worried about that, if you do any research on professional writers, one of the great Americans, E.B. White, the American writer, I mean, if you saw his drafts, or if you see other professional writers' drafts, I mean, they have many, many drafts, and there's lines across, et cetera, et cetera, and it takes multiple drafts, and it depends on who you are. And I'm never satisfied with the finished product ever, and I don't really want to look at it sometimes. But there's the perfectionism as well. You must draw a line somewhere and say, well, this is all the time I'm going to put into this particular piece, take it or leave it. But that doesn't mean you try and write from the very first instance, I must get the right vocabulary, I must get the right grammar, no, you just, excuse me and excuse to the readers, you must puke it on the page, as I always say. Just let it out there. And then you actually, a person I worked with, Jack Richards, who's very world famous in our field. I worked in 2 books, and that's what he does. He just lets it out, and then you massage it. That's his word. You massage it after that, and how much you want to massage it depends on you, but you also draw a line under it. And then you let somebody else read it. It's very important somebody else read it. And then it's up to you to be able to figure out, well, how am I going to take their analysis of my writing? But again, the trusting yourself part is very important. The writer's block, per se, comes from the point where somebody is at the page, the interface with the page or the word processing, and to get those first few words down. That's where you have to develop the trust in yourself, and you let it go, just write it out. Doesn't matter if you're writing about reflective practice or you're writing about autumn, you just let it out. And don't worry about grammar, don't worry about anything. When you read the first page or whatever, just keep writing as long as you can, then move away from it. Don't read it, move away. Even if it's 5 minutes, a day is good. 3 days, whatever. And then you come back to it, and then you don't criticize yourself. Oh, now I see where I'm going with this. Honestly speaking, when I start something, I have a vague idea only. Vague. I never do an outline. I have a vague idea. I let myself decide where it's going, and that includes writing, it includes jogging, it includes tea in the pub, you know what I mean? And when I get onto a project, I actually, the second point, which I'm not sure I would, I don't think people should really get as intense as I do, but I get very intense when I write, and I write vast amounts, and I want to get it finished. And when I get it finished, I leave it, and then I come back to it again. But when I start, I always say, I'm going to finish this. I never, ever leave anything. Now, certain products are on my computer for some time, but they will be finished. I leave that for the moment, and then I never stick at just one project. And the reason is you can get caught. That's where you can get caught, in the block area, and then you never go on to anything else. I always like to work on multiple projects, and then one feeds the other too sometimes. And when you read for some research or whatever for one project, oh, wait a minute, this relates to another.
So what are you writing right at the moment?
Actually, I think I just mentioned earlier, I'm just starting a new book, and it's an overall reflective framework for reflective practice for all areas of second language teachers, from novice to experience, and it has 5 levels, and I even go beyond reflective practice to critical reflective practice and how it impacts society life as well. I have the framework, but I haven't written that yet, so I'm beginning to get excited about this, and the first chapter will be an introduction to reflective practice. Do you know how many times I've written that chapter in many of my books? But this is going to be completely different, because I have a whole research aspect to reflective practice outside teaching English. Now, it's very big in medicine, especially in nursing, for cancer patients and other chronically ill patients. Nurses are encouraged to reflect on their practice. Doctors are encouraged. Business as well. So what I did was I researched over the past 3 years those areas. And I was lucky enough, I got it. Do you know what a SHRC grant is? A Social Science Research Fund of Canada grant?
Heard of it.
Yeah, I got it about 4 years ago, about $50,000 to research, actually 3 teachers, experienced teachers, as they reflected on their work. And they're in the area. Wonderful teachers. We worked together for 2 years. I facilitated their meetings. From that grant, I was able to buy a whole lot of updated books, reflective practice in outside teaching, such as in medicine and whatnot. And I spent the past 3 years reading those and taking notes and putting it all together. And this, all of this is going to be fueled into my new book. I would call it my magnum opus. But it's going to be thin, believe it or not. It's going to be thinner than any other one, because I want to make it accessible to people, accessible to teachers, native and non-native speaker teachers. See, it must be readable from, let's say, a non-native perspective as well. So I try to make it jargon-free as much as possible. If I do, I try to explain it.
And anyone who has read a legal document will know it's more difficult to write in a more accessible, easy to understand manner.
Yeah.
That's a talent.
It is, because many people think that academic writing is supposed to be obscure, and many academics make it obscure on purpose so that they're the only ones that understand it. I don't understand that, and I encourage my students to keep it simple, because if you ever want to get a job in a company, in a whatever, in business, the clearer you are writing memos, the better it is, especially if people understand it. But legalese, so to speak, I mean, that's how they make their money. I mean, if we all understood it, then we wouldn't need lawyers. I won't get off on that one.
I was down in Stratford this summer, and I watched a play by John Murrow called Taking Shakespeare. In the play, Martha Henry plays a university professor who is in the twilight of her career, as it were. And she is sent the son of the Dean of Humanities, who is not into Shakespeare. And his mother figures, I'm going to send her to this teacher to tutor him in the play Othello. If anybody can do it, she can. But the teacher, they don't hit it off right away. And one of the things the teacher says, because she's obviously totally frustrated with her educational career at this point in time, she says, the Dean of Humanities is just unhappy with me because I haven't published anything in years. What's the pressure on you as someone at a university to keep publishing? Do you have to, or is it a case of you want to?
You know, that's a great question, and it's an important question, because the hallmark of an academic, of a professor, is that you get your work out there for the masses to read, be they academics or students or whatnot. Each institution is different, but in order to get tenured at a university, you have to have a certain amount of publications. It's after tenure, which is quite interesting, which I think your question is very important, because some professors after tenure don't write anything. They don't feel the pressure to do it, and it's up to the university to enforce whatever rules they have in place, and some of them do and some of them don't. It's difficult to define the area of research. I mean, the ultimate end product of research is a publication, but do you judge a professor on the ultimate end, which is how many publications, or do you judge a professor on ING in doing research, and it may not lead to a publication? publication. That's the difficult aspect. And it's not easy to publish, let me tell you. It's not easy. When you want to write a book, especially, you have to have a track record. As an academic, you earn your track record with academic peer-reviewed articles in journals. And now there's just so many people trying to publish at all ages that it's still very difficult to publish. The word integrity is very important for me. And I think integrity as a professor means you should publish as an end product, an article or more, including books. I think it's the hallmark of your PhD, which is a doctor in philosophy. You know, it's not an end product. When somebody gets a PhD, it's like a black belt in Taekwondo or Judo, whatever. It doesn't mean you're finished. It means now you're in trouble. You start. It's the beginning. Some professors may just put down the pen, so to speak, and say, well, I'm tenured and that's it. I mean, I won't speak for them. I just speak for myself. I think integrity is very important. And the ultimate result of being a professor, I think, is end publications, be they journal articles or books or whatever. So I think it's very important. As for pressure, I'm not sure, you know, within Brock, that's every year you have annual reviews and you know, whatever colleagues do, they write in their annual review and they give it to the dean, and it's up to the dean then to decide whether it's appropriate or not, because you have unions and all that kind of stuff. So
we'll let you go back to your writing and your jogging and everything else, but fascinating conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. Will you come back and talk to us again?
I will, yes, and thanks very much for inviting me, Mike, and all you out there in Brockland or wherever land, enjoy.
That was Professor Thomas Farrell, Chair of the Department of Applied Linguistics at Brock, on his many and varied publications and how he has time to write them all. It's amazing. The Council of Ontario Universities will be hosting a panel discussion in London, Ontario, November 26th, entitled Research Matters, an Ontario-wide campaign to connect university researchers to the broader public. Each year, the campaign presents 5 events throughout the province where researchers share their work with the public. In London, on November 26th, researchers from the Universities of Waterloo and Windsor, Western University, Wilfrid Laurier University, and Brock University will all be participating. Brock will be represented by researcher and medical microbiologist Anna Sanchez, a community health sciences associate professor at Brock, who will be speaking on how can we eradicate infectious diseases. The event will be held at the London Children's Museum and will be part of a live webcast from 6:30 to 9 p.m. November 26th. A couple of Research Matters student ambassadors come from Brock University, Julia Pollock O'Neill and Jory Korbanek. Julia is an interdisciplinary humanities PhD student who sits on the Research and Scholarship Policy Committee, while Jory is a physics PhD student and president of the Graduate Students Association. Both Pollock O'Neill and Korbanek visited our CFBU-FM studios recently to talk about the Research Matters event, and I asked just what a student ambassador does.
Well, we are responsible for public outreach, but also we speak to students in the Brock community about research and research activities in Brock and 21 research universities of Ontario.
So this does not coincide directly with Research Matters, the event coming up on the 26th of November. This is an ongoing thing, in other words?
It is under the Research Matters umbrella.
Say November 27th, are you still research ambassadors or are you done?
Personally, I see this as an ongoing thing. Public outreach is an important part of this program, and even though the event finishes, I think it's definitely something that's ongoing in a sense, but I think officially we may be more or less finished.
Carrying the banner unofficially then, yeah. After the camp. Now, you're both researchers yourselves, I presume.
That's correct, yep. Yes.
Researching a specific field of study for both of you?
I do experimental condensed matter physics, so I work with frustrated magnetic materials, so it's magnetic materials that have unusual low temperature states.
And I'm kind of the opposite of Jory. In my research, I study interdisciplinary humanities, and my background is in visual art, history, and theory, as well as English language and literature.
You are diametrically opposed.
Yes.
I can't get over that. You threw the frustrated word in there, which didn't necessarily frustrate me, but it surprised me. In a nutshell, can you sort of give us like an encapsulated version of what that means then?
Essentially, what it means is that the system can't necessarily decide what state that it wants to be in. And the reason why this occurs is based on the geometry of the crystal structure of the material. So basically, the way that the atoms are laid out gives rise to this frustration. And so it just doesn't know how to behave.
And I suspect there's a little bit of frustration on your part when you're doing the research on this.
Oh, yeah, of course. experimentalists, we often fight with our equipment. That's probably what we do 80% of the time. But yeah, it's probably the most difficult thing I've ever done, so that's why I like to do it.
I have to ask, working on something like this, what piqued your interest to begin with, to get into this area of study?
Well, I started with an applied project working on red phosphors for LED lights, and I thought I would enjoy something that had more of an application. But as I was doing the work, I don't know, I think I just felt drawn to the unusual and exciting things that are coming from this field. So there's very unusual states of matter that we're finding with these frustrated systems. And our lab is quite well equipped to do these types of measurements, and it's just a challenge, so it's exciting.
Okay, well, Julia, we can't hog all the research information here. You're in an entirely different arena altogether, so your research is taking you where?
Well, my research, interestingly, has led me to research a figure in the Canadian cultural landscape, Douglas Copeland. And what's interesting about him is that within his body of work, all of my research interests are kind of addressed, because he is a visual artist as well as a writer. And it's really interesting to see how he basically encompasses all of my various interests. And as I advance in my research, I'm finding that his work is profoundly interesting.
Think of both of you doing entirely different types of research. The end result is theoretically the paper that you put out at the end of it, but the approach to it must be totally different for both of you. So let's start with you, Jory. How are you conducting your research?
Basically, how it works is, I guess we're both creative, but creative in different ways. I have to be creative when I'm looking at the types of materials that I want to design, and then I go about and make these materials in a lab using furnaces and high temperatures, and I mix together powders and different things like that. And once I'm done making my material, that's when I go through and I essentially measure its physical properties, and then I try to understand why it behaves the way it does. The inherent nature of the material itself, and that's what essentially condensed matter physicist does.
Okay, now Julia, presumably no furnaces are involved in your research other than the one that heats up the room that you're working in at that particular moment.
That's correct. It's a little bit of a different context and climate.
This is the wonderful thing about research. There are so many ways to conduct research and to get to the destination that as a researcher you want to arrive at, but there's no one set way. I suspect that maybe one of the things that would come out of the Research Matters event coming up on November the 26th, all these people coming together to talk about the methods and ways that they use to get the information that they need for their project.
One thing that I found very interesting in just thinking about research as a general topic is how it impacts society and culture at large. I think Research Matters is seeking to address is that research is very exciting and it impacts so many different parts of our lives. And I think that an awareness of that will show the value of research just in its inherent value.
That's the amazing thing about an event such as this, because I term it cross-pollination of different researchers coming together and meshing, if you will, during this event, because everyone is going about their research in a different way. Research is research, but it's how you get to the set point that you want to get to.
Yeah, I think that's the exciting aspect about this program. Is the main goal is the public outreach aspect, but it's also good to get as many researchers in a room as you can fit, essentially, and talk about our ideas, because you'd be really surprised how things in one field can be transferred and used in another field. I'll give you just a quick example in the field of biology and in the field of computer science. So in computer science, there's something called sort of these genetic algorithms or these genetic programs. And what computer scientists have done is they've taken ideas that a biologist has developed using in evolutionary biology and now have tried to apply it in their own field. So it's always exciting to get as many minds as you can together.
As a researcher, you can't live in a vacuum. You have to be out there interacting with like-minded individuals. in order to generate that information from wherever. You never know where it's going to come from.
As a humanities scholar, I find it very interesting to actually hold conversations with people who are in drastically different fields from myself. Transdisciplinarity is a really big concept in universities right now, and we don't really have a lot of formal occasion to speak to people who are in completely different fields. It happens generally on an informal basis. So an event like the Research Matters event is a great opportunity to experience and to listen to a variety of researchers from completely different fields who are having an effect on our lives and the environment and our culture.
Research Matters coming up on November 26th is not a one-off thing. This is an ongoing thing, I understand. These go on periodically throughout the year.
That's correct. And what's interesting also is that researchers from a variety of Ontario universities are participating in each event. So Dr. Anna Sanchez, who's our Research Matters researcher from Brock University, she's going to be presenting in London, Ontario, which is a really interesting opportunity. And we're going to be holding an event at Brock where people can assemble and participate by actually communicating with the researchers via Twitter.
That's during the event on the 26th.
Yes, that's during the event on the 26th.
And I believe it's one at Alfie's Trough that there's going to be the webcast set up and people will be able to watch it, interact, take part in it. I don't think there's a single Brock student who wouldn't know where Alfie's Trough was, but for the benefit of those off campus, can you give us sort of a quick idea where it is?
It's somewhat tucked away on the escarpment, but essentially, if you're familiar with the Thistle Hallway, if you go down Thistle in that area and kind of head towards the forest, you're going to hit it. It's actually formerly the undergraduate pub, and it's built right on the escarpment itself, so it has quite a stunning view.
You notice how Jory had no difficulty at all describing how to get there. Does that come from experience, sir?
Yes. I've been there a few times. I've patroned their establishment.
Most people, I'm sure, don't know the extent of research being done in universities, not only here in the province of Ontario, but really around the world. It impacts all of our lives in so many ways, and yet a lot of people probably aren't aware of the extent of the research being done.
Yeah, I would agree. I think maybe this is kind of off topic, but what kind of drew me into this program, in a sense, coming from my field, I think researchers in general, or academics in general, but especially academics in my field in physics, we don't do really a fantastic job explaining to the public what it is we do and what we are doing, why it's important. So that's probably the sort of major aspect.
Do you think people realize the value of research in society today?
Just speaking for myself, I started to realize how academics are active researchers only when I was in graduate studies. I don't know why I didn't make the connection, but when I developed a stronger relationship with my supervisor, I realized that he's always publishing. It's the humanities, it's a little bit different from the sciences, but they're constantly working. It's part of their job, and they're generating new information, new opinions, new ways of connecting various discourses. It's absolutely fascinating, and especially when you think about things that are more applied in the sciences, there's a lot of developments that are being applied to society and to things like medicine and the economy that have been generated by university researchers. It's really surprising when you step back and think about it.
More importantly, I think governments, do they realize the importance of research? I'm getting a couple of smiles here.
Yeah, I think in a sense, government understands the benefit of research. One of the things I know in sciences, and one of the issues that some researchers are facing now, is there's a trend that we need to be able to commercialize our work, and that people aren't necessarily able to study pure science for, you know, pure science's sake, or just study something, studying for the love of it. And I can understand why they want to see a direct economic impact, perhaps. But I think what is important to realize is that even if there isn't necessarily a gadget or something that comes out of research,
a lot of times there are tons of examples where just pure science or just pure research in general contributes to the economic environment of a culture, or even just the cultural impact is important as well.
I'm not sure if this would be different for either one of you or similar, but I'm curious as to how modern technology would have changed the role of the researcher from both of your perspectives.
One thing that I find really interesting, especially just in recently examining Twitter for the purposes of research matters, is that it's becoming more and more common for scholars of all disciplines to reach out to each other via social media. And it's interesting how it's very effective. You're able to connect with researchers across the country. I'm actually in communication with some American researchers who are in a similar field, and I'm participating in American conferences as a result. But certainly social media has had a large impact. And then at Brock, in my program, we have a field of digital humanities, which is an entirely new field. I should say it's emergent, and they definitely understand the importance of digital and electronic media.
Jory, for you?
Well, aside from, I guess one could say, advances in laboratory equipment, which is incredibly important, and just even in computer, you know, computing, the powers of computing, people can study systems that they possibly couldn't study 10 years ago, just, you know, strictly from that standpoint. But I would also have to agree with the connectivity of people. It's a lot easier for questions to be asked and answers to be given with the internet, and there's various forums like ResearchGate where it sort of pairs up researchers by field of study, and you can look at questions that people have asked that may be similar to you. So aside from, I guess, the more obvious advances in lab equipment and computers, that would be the major.
So could you see yourself doing the kind of research you're doing now, say 20 years ago, with the technology that would have been available then?
I was actually just thinking about that. And the way that we access material and are able to carry ongoing conversations is profoundly different now than it was 20 years ago. We can access things via open access journals as well as other electronic publications. And I find that profoundly helpful. Rather than going through paper copy in libraries and having limited access to information is almost unlimited at this point.
I've talked to so many researchers here on the program since I began it. The one thing I find is almost always there, front and center, is a passion. It really comes down to a passion. There has to be a passion there for what you do.
I would definitely have to agree. I'm currently doing my PhD, so it's a very substantial amount of work and effort. And if you're not enjoying what you're doing, you aren't just going to succeed. It would be impossible, I think. And this is what motivates us. There's a passion and, you know, like you said, a passion or just a curiosity. And that's the major motivating feature for everyone. And that's why we do what we do. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I'm here, is just to express my excitement for just research in general.
Julia and Jory, thank you both for coming in. We're looking forward to the event on the 26th. And good luck, both of you, with your research.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
There we heard from a couple of Brock student ambassadors getting the word out on the upcoming Research Matters event, November 26th. Jory Korbanek is a physics PhD student and president of the Graduate Students Association, while Julia Pollock O'Neill is an interdisciplinary humanities PhD student who sits on the Research and Scholarship Policy Committee. The evening event, held in London, Ontario, will be broadcast live via webcast, and you can catch it, even participate in it, at Brock on the evening of the 26th. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind.